Good evening. This is Mae Bressel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers. It's December the 16th, 1985, and there are only 3 more weeks left in this year. I can't believe it, but that happens to be true. I'm going to change the format of the program a little bit with you and share as many articles as I can in the next 3 weeks because I spend a lot of time outlining a particular article or story with you. You know the format of this broadcast. And there are literally hundreds of other items left sitting on the desk or in drawers or files, probably never to be used again. So I'm going to share some of those with you, just a few thoughts on them, and just mention them so that you know that I am receiving this information and that it is of vital importance to the general overall research. Before I begin that part of the program, I just want to thank all of you for the past year or years for listening to World Watchers, for sharing information, for sharing your research, your findings, books, articles that you locate for me or for David Emery and Nip Tuck. And this is a very special privilege. I can't think of any single radio person who has covered this kind of material or any material, much less controversial politics, 1 hour a week of uninterrupted radio time. And that included 12 years on a commercial radio station where there were no breaks during the entire hour, and I could just share newspaper articles and information and documents with you. It's a very unusual opportunity, and I'm very grateful for it. This is an age of specialists. There are people that break down their specialties in medicine, in science, in the arts, and there are unlimited kinds, hundreds and hundreds of specialists in various fields. And those people who study politics and narrow it down to anti-fascism, to fighting fascism, to fighting propaganda, to fighting lies in the newspapers or in books, or try to understand the society in which we live, are a specialty of their own. And this kind of work, which I don't consider work, I consider it play because I really love it, is so much better because it is shared with you people. You have the privilege to take your finger, move that dial one little bit, and turn off and get some nice, sweet music. But these listeners who buy the books, that question the government, that investigate, that hear Mae Bressel and try to entertain a new idea in their head, other than the one that they're just handed out, are a very special breed. They have their own energy. They have their own intelligence. They come from all walks of life. I've met many of you, I've talked to you, I've corresponded with you. Some are very poor students or people on limited income, some very, very limited income. Some are very wealthy. Some people are very educated in a formal way. Some have really been self-educated beyond high school, not much opportunity. There is no constant factor on the kind of personality who wants to study society or government or wants to make it better, knows something is wrong, and wants to make it better. So I share that with you, and I thank you, and I hope you have a really good next year. Stay healthy and happy, and thanks for all your psychological support, your actual support, and for the wonderful time and space that we have been able to use this time, the radio time, the cassette time, and so forth, to come into your homes, and then you in turn come back to me and make a circle of acquaintanceship that is very rich because I believe we are special people. Now, I'm going to run through, as I say, as fast as I can, many of the current articles that I do want to share with you at this time. One is an article from New York Times, the science section, C1, November 25th, on the emotional impact of disaster. And it's titled, The Sense of the Benign World is Lost. And it's based upon research of a Dr. Horowitz, a psychiatrist at the University of California in San Francisco. And he lists certain events that take place that affect us. He cites the Mexican earthquake or the Colombian mudslide, but major cataclysmic events and how we respond in a normal way, 5 different ways of dealing in a sequential order with that particular event. And what he describes as normal response is normal response to a normal event. And then he lists the pathological response to that event. But what people are feeling is a normal response to a pathological event. And there's quite a difference there. A normal event is something beyond our control, somebody that we really like, an actor, a writer, a politician, who has a death that wasn't caused, that wasn't political, and we can handle that. Political assassinations, I think, go in the category of these terrible tragedies. And he lists what he calls a normal response and then cites the event, and your first reaction is outcry, fear, sadness, and rage. Your next should be, if it's normal, a denial, refusal to face some of this memory of the disaster, it hurts too much, and then an intrusion into your thoughts, events that make you have to accept it, and then you work through this. The next stage is you work through the reality of what happened, and finally you complete it and you go on with your life. Now, that is given those events over which nobody had any control. Nobody is suspicious that they were caused. They are untimely. They shake us up. We deal with them, and then we complete them. Then he lists a set of psychological responses, six in particular, that I'll cite for you. But he calls these pathological responses as something wrong to what is a normal event. And what I think the difference is that he's missing or doesn't deal with, or would never deal with, is that we are dealing with pathological sick minds who are forcing us to respond these ways because we know they are causing these events. The murder of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Medgar Evers, Mahatma Gandhi, Mrs. Gandhi, peace-loving people, Samantha Smith, Janis Joplin, Otis Redding, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, John Lennon, and the list goes on and on of people we have lost, and there have been many studies and investigations questioning the way they were killed. And so he lists six states of mind which I think people are feeling today, which are the normal response to abnormal events, to pathological events. And they're not pathological responses to a normal event. And the first one he lists is being overwhelmed or swept away by the immediate emotional reaction. Well, every time some peace-loving person, another peace-loving person is killed, a civil rights leader, cancer, the Martha Mitchell type cancer because she speaks, the Jack Ruby cancer when he's speaking and talking about who killed John Kennedy and he knows the people behind it. There's an emotional reaction to the murder of witnesses, to people who say their word and all of a sudden they're swept away. The second response he talks about is panic or exhaustion. Many people response to these events that want to listen to World Watchers, want to read certain books but can't, is that they're exhausted. They come home and they say at the end of the day, I just want to have a beer and watch the football game or the baseball game, and they go to entertainment and TV tonight, and what's entertainment? Your choice of movies, interviewers, TV, soap operas. There's panic and exhaustion, which is absolutely not a pathological response, but a normal response to a bad situation. The third way he says that people respond that's pathological is extreme avoidance, resorting to measures as drugs to deny the pain. Well, we have the prescription drugs that go into the billions, the over-the-counter drugs, the illegal drugs, the alcohol, and I even think TV is a drug. There's an extreme avoidance because in our psyche, in the American psyche today, too many people know that something is wrong. They don't want to know what it is, just as those huge statistics on the Kennedy assassination years ago. 65% of the country didn't think Oswald did it alone, but they didn't want to know who did it. That's called extreme avoidance. And the next state he calls about is flooded states, disturbing persistent images and thoughts of the events. And we reconstruct. We have our TV histories, our docudrama. We live over the story of the Holocaust of Charles Manson. It's on video cassettes. You can buy it now. The Manson family, the lies that the video makes to make us feel better, but they pour disinformation again, so people still aren't satisfied. There is a long docudrama on Mussolini this past month, and then the reviews of it were terrible. They made him out as a ladies' man, a Renaissance man, and it still doesn't answer the need people have for how did it happen, who is he, and so forth. And then there's the psychosomatic responses, bodily complaints, where there's no resolution. And I believe that two-thirds of the cancers today and the diseases and the sinuses and the hemorrhoids and the high blood pressure and the ulcers and all the heart attacks and the hearts that are put in, the mechanical hearts and so forth, create all kinds of physical conditions that send you to doctors. Howard Hughes referred to the medical institute as the fourth largest industry in the United States, the health industry, because these events have thrown you into psychosomatic responses. And then the last is character distortions, long-term distortions of the ability to love or to work. People forget. They have to be taught on KQED by Leo Busaglio on how to love, how to hug somebody, how to say, I love you, how to feel. And the Me Too generation has taken away the feeling. The Ayn Rand philosophy of selfishness is coming in, the distortion of what we are or who we are or how we feel. How do you cook a home-cooked meal? Do you put it in a microwave oven for 2 minutes? Do you sit down with the family and have a microwave-baked apple or microwave cookie or some popcorn? Or do you take time and make a preparation of something that is aesthetic, that smells good, tastes good, that you enjoy? Are people sitting down? The fast food is a character distortion of what a home is, what a place should be for nurturing and sharing conversation and so forth. So the psychological responses that Dr. Horowitz has listed are not pathological responses to normal events, but are normal responses to pathological events that are simply flooding us today, and it's just difficult to keep track of all of them. Now, Mr. Gorbachev spoke with Ronald Reagan in Moscow, not in Moscow, in Geneva, about things that are happening in the United States, because he knew Ronald Reagan was going to talk about civil rights in the Soviet Union. And he talked about buildings being desecrated by swastikas, by millions of people unemployed. There's 23,000 homeless on the streets of New York right now. And he expressed his concept of right-wing extremism. And I'm sure it included people like Franklin Camper and camps that we have that are teaching people how to kill other people. And Mr. Gorbachev couldn't help but mention a flawed and doomed United States political system. You know, the elections have been over since 1960. There hasn't been a real election since 1960. It's all show. And he brought up the contrast of our thinking that capitalism is affluent and that we're running out of money, and cited some examples of that, and shared his ideas of the Western world with the president and George Shultz. And, of course, the American media, the San Jose Mercury, had a long reprint from the Washington Post on this. George Shultz wondered, well, where is Mr. Gorbachev getting his information? Imagine the idea that America's teetering near the brink of economic collapse, that there's skyrocketing unemployment, that there's deficits and budget fiascos. Where in the world would he get his information? And, of course, all he had to do was read any newspaper the week of the summit to realize that there had to be an emergency bill passed to pay for the gasoline to get the president over to the summit meeting, that the people with him and working for him didn't have paychecks if they didn't put some kind of a quickie into Congress to pay for the trip. And the statistics on our budget, our deficits, and so forth is well known throughout the world, and it's shaking a lot of people. They're worried about it. So he brought this up, and I thought after I read this article that I would just save from my newspapers that I started cutting when I saw this, just murders and swastikas and right-wing racism, hatred in the United States, and scotch tape these articles to pieces of paper and maybe make some kind of a book and send it to the public officials in the Soviet Union and in Washington and say, where in the world did Mr. Gorbachev get this idea that there's violence or terrorism in the streets of America? And just show you how many ways people are murdering each other. One man took his stepson and daughter, stepdaughter, and murdered them while the wife was working, and he put nails into the head of the child. Another woman was acquitted. She put the child in the oven. There's the most tremendous violence of horrible proportions of what people are doing to each other. And maybe in December, not December, January or February, I'll take just 2 weeks and just read off some of these pages just as they come in no particular order, because no death is more important than any others, but they're just horrible. Just this past week, the son of one of the founders of the University of California, Mr. Sproul, Sproul Hall is named after him, he commits suicide. The head attorney for the University of California jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge. He said, I can't cope with stress anymore. And he was making decisions on how to divest the University of California money that goes to South Africa. And all of a sudden, he sends a love letter to his daughter and his wife as he flies over the bridge into the water and cracks himself into how many pieces, we don't know. But these are attorneys, lawyers, prominent people, and if they're not doing to themselves like Mr. Deek, they're being murdered by people who were formerly, this woman who killed Mr. Deek, I mentioned him last week, was a teacher at the University of California down in Santa Barbara. Now, to understand what Mr. Gorbachev was saying, I just have to go back to the charter of the United States, CIA, and the National Security Council, because I'm always fingering National Security Council as the instance that made it legal to change the United States of America. And to understand the news that follows in the next 3 to 4 weeks that I just pour out with you, or that in the year to come in 1986 or past World Watchers, you have to be reminded of where we change and how we change. And the references come from Senator Frank Church's committee investigating the CIA, the Rockefeller Committee, and they were cited also in a book, CIA in the Dock, the author V. Chernyansky, published in Moscow in 1983, not Soviet propaganda, but what America does to itself around the world to other people and how we made it legal. So from this particular book, CIA in the Dock, there's just two or three sentences describing what we gave ourselves the permission to do. And then if you understand that everything that is here is legal, then you can understand how the news falls into the shape it does now, based upon our, in quotes, legality to sabotage, to kill, to overthrow. Now, this book says, covert action is activity which is meant to further the sponsoring of the nation's foreign policy objectives, and which is to be concealed in order to permit the nation to plausibly deny responsibility. And covert action is in the news a lot the past few weeks. And I believe that the Middle East, the TWA hijacking, the Killie Laura, and the recent killing of 60 people in the last hijacking are all covert actions. And this is why I want to cite these references. The covert action, again, is a sponsoring of an activity that leads to our objective, namely anti-communism. To blame it on the communists is really the goal, the leftists, the terrorists instigated from Moscow or Lebanon or Syria. It's to be concealed to permit this nation to plausibly deny responsibility. The National Security Act of 1947, which established the Central Intelligence Agency, did not include specific authority for covert action. However, it created the National Security Council the same year. And when the National Security Council was created, it gave that body the authority to direct the CIA to perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence affecting the national security as the National Security Council may from time to time direct. And at its first meeting, December 1947, we have an anniversary there from 1947 in December, the National Security Council issued a top secret directive granting the CIA authority to conduct their covert operations. That means do anything you want as long as you're not caught, and if you're caught, you can deny it and the threads or change of command won't be there. This directive instructed the CIA to counter, to reduce, or discredit anywhere international communism. Communism is defined by them. Throughout the world, in any country, in any manner consistent with United States foreign and military policies. And that's why it's so important to elect the right president if you had the choice of an election. And that's why they've taken the electoral choice from you with the bullet and blackmail, because that person in power directs us not only what we do right in the United States with our 50 states, but any country in the world, any foreign or military policies. It also directed the CIA to undertake their covert operations to achieve this end. That is their end, and it is defined by the activities they take, the covert activities, as being related to, one, to propaganda. Propaganda could be anything from influencing to outright lies. Two, economic warfare. Three, political action, including sabotage. I might say economic warfare is giving huge loans from the International Monetary Fund to countries like Brazil and Mexico, $500 billion, or Peru, or third world countries, knowing they can't pay back, then putting the squeeze and literally owning the countries. That's economic warfare. Also to take flight capital out of countries such as India, the Rewald CIA connections, flight capital out of Bolivia, and various countries, if the dictatorship's going to fall, Dominican Republic and so forth, and even out of the United States now, into Swiss banks, so particular countries collapse, flight capital is economic warfare. Also, political action is allowed, including sabotage. Sabotage is everything from hijacking to sinking to breaking up dams or buildings or causing man-made earthquakes. I believe they can happen. And they were allowed sabotage, demolition, and the assistance to resistance movements. Now, resistance movements are people such as the Somozans, who were dictators. Somoza was a cruel, harsh dictator put in by the United States. So when he's thrown out, then the resistance to get rid of the new government becomes funded by our army, our Contras, the Vatican, and so forth. We don't fund the resistance movement in El Salvador against the death squads. And we didn't fund the resistance movement in Nicaragua and the mass killings that were taking place there. The resistance movement is to fight somebody like Salvador Allende and put in Pinochet. In every case, it is to fund the money to assure a dictator and to destroy a democracy because there is not as much profit in a democracy where wages are fair and the American corporations can make less from the slave labor. So we can assist resistant movements in all activities compatible with this directive. In 1962, the CIA's General Counsel rendered the opinion that the agency's activities were not inhibited by any limitation. And keep in mind, by 1960, the CIA had used Robert Mayhew to hire John Rosselli and Sam Giancana for assassination teams that were in fact used, set up in 60, but were used to kill John Kennedy 1 year later in 1963. This is the description of the National Security Council and the activities they can do, the covert activities, the sabotage, the assassinations, the propaganda, and so forth. And with that green light that you can do all of that for so long, how can you separate in the news those events that are caused by our intelligence community? Because the National Security Council includes the Defense Intelligence Agency and Navy Intelligence and the Army Intelligence more than just the CIA. It's the combined intelligence that is doing all of this. Now, to analyze the hijacking situation in the Middle East, the Washington Post had a long article called Motive Missing in Egypt Air Hijacking, a new breed who killed willingly and with no remorse. It's dated December the 1st. 1985, page A33. You might want to copy it from the Washington Post. And the idea was that how do you account for this hijacking and nearly 60 lives were lost? It led to those lives that are lost with Achille Lauro or the TWA. And it's the idea that there's a new breed of Palestinians or people from the Middle East who have no motive, that their motive is missing. Now, the nerve of describing them without motive. When in 1947 we set up those conditions that we could do all the things that we have charged them with doing, which I believe were assisted by United States intelligence, and call it a new breed of killing, which is the ultimate of hypocrisy. This isn't a new breed of killer. These are the killers that have been trained by the United States, armed by the United States, And they're doing what we want them to do. We wouldn't have sent Reinhard Galen's agents and Otto Skorzeny to train all these people into these kinds of murderous acts if we didn't want an excuse to destabilize the area and bring in the United States troops and to pretend to be the big saviors and really to take over these countries. Now, a recent article, November 19th, has a picture of Dr. George Habash. It's called A Terrorist for Hire, and they call him a Marxist-Leninist leader. I wrote about George Habash with regard to his relationship to Larry McDonald and Murder Incorporated in the United States, and linked him to the CIA and Mr. Pinochet in Chile. And this recent article has a picture of him trying to say he's a Marxist-Leninist whose group was responsible for killing U.S. Military attaché Lieutenant Colonel Charles Ray in Paris and an Israeli diplomat in Paris, and for the assassination in Rome in 1984 of Mr. Lyman Hunt, U.S. commander of the multinational force in the Sinai. Now, this recent plane that went down of the peacekeeping group in the Sinai, I believe, was a sabotage plane, and they're trying to link Mr. Habash to the same ilk that they did Carlos the Terrorist, when Carlos and Mr. Habash both worked with George Turpel and Edwin Wilson and Mr. Ernest von Kaiser from the Wehrmacht, Hitler's army that went into the United States Army. Our terrorists have been trained by Adolf Hitler, and the top team have been trained by Hitler's army. So in order to account for the terrorism in Europe and the killing of the head of the peacekeeping force in Sinai, Habash is pictured, and Habash has always been linked to the United States and the CIA. Not always been linked, but through a lot of material. Another article of interest that should scare a lot of people this week, the San Jose Mercury and Associated Press has AIDS parallels found in Bible, chemist says. Now, this is an interview in London done by a British chemist working in New York City that says that the disease similar to AIDS was found in the Bible and that Moses suggested you kill all the potential carriers. Now, you may think that is a joke or some biblical comparison of a far-out loony, but the person saying it is John Gwilt, G-W-I-L-T, vice president of the New York-based Sterling Drug, which is IG Farben. Now, Farben designed Zyklon B and could exterminate 6 million Jews and maybe 2 million other people by gas. I don't have the exact figures. Could set up a death factory with ovens and crematorium. And now, in 1985, they're hinting that you killed potential carriers. Just last week, I gave blood, and we had to take a test, and then they go through it and see if, clear it out, that you don't have any symptom of being a carrier for AIDS. What did they selectively say to a particular person? You're a carrier. You have to be killed. And this chemist from Sterling Drug, the same IG Farben that Pope John Paul II worked for at Auschwitz, is suggesting that there is a biblical explanation of a solution to the disease AIDS. The article said Gwilt, visiting London, spoke in a telephone interview with the Associated Press. He's made a lifelong study of medical references to the Bible and finds striking parallels to modern diseases. Now, I'll take a one-minute break and just go back into this concept of modern diseases. At Fort Derrick, Maryland, they are planning a disease that will not respond to any medications and breaks down the immune systems. Did they have the assistance in conceiving such a horrible thing of scientists from IG Farben who worked closely with our government and are now coming out with the fact, because there are millions, I think it's 22 million people now, who are potential aid carriers. I think that was the statistic I heard last week. Are they coming out with the idea to kill the carriers because the Bible has given permission? These things have happened in many of our lifetimes before. Some of you were young, but it happened right in front of us. If it happened then and those people work for the government now, why can't it happen here? And I believe it will. And this is a dangerous route to go, to say kill the carriers. Permission is given in the Bible, and it comes from Sterling Drug, IG Farben. Well, I did get to explain that one, so now we'll take the one-minute break and go on to another story. I didn't know if I would have time to share that with you, but I did, and we'll continue in 1 minute with some more of the grisly news.